Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Nall. Nice to have you with us today. Normally, we would be doing a segment on health and nutrition, the environment, and then important issues or a guest. Today, this program is so important, it is an exclusive, in-depth discussion live with my guest who will be in Germany. I'll introduce him in a second. The topic is COVID-19 pandemic narrative. Can we believe it? Or should it be challenged? My guest is challenging it. He is one of the most credentialed scientists, medical doctors in the world. And it's rare to have someone like this on. We have him on. How long it will take, I don't know. As long as he continues to share unique insights, we'll continue the interview. But we have part two as a backup. From yesterday's program, where one of the top lawyers in the world, criminal lawyers, international lawyers, is now working with a whole consortium of lawyers and scientists and physicians to deconstruct what they consider the extremely irresponsible narrative and policies behind the COVID pandemic. People really enjoyed yesterday's segment. We will have that as a backup. But if today's show is what I hope it is, we'll have the entire hour. Please understand the information we're going to share is scientifically valid. It has been independently verified. And no matter how extreme it sounds compared to the official narrative, it is real. What is not real are the pundits from respected institutions like the New York Times and, for example, the Washington Post, who have become, in my opinion, merely propagandists for the official position. So today, I do not trust without challenge anything from the official scientific establishment tied to the pharmaceutical industrial complex, tied to the media, tied to official Washington. So now, I'll introduce my guest. Now joining us from Germany via Skype is Dr. Sucharit Bhakdi. That's B-H-A-K-D-I. He is an American-born physician trained in Germany and has been in the medical field now for 5 decades, half a century. He received his medical degree from the University of Bonn and his postdoctoral work at the prestigious Max Planck Institute of Immunology and Immunobiology and Epigenetics before becoming an associate professor at the Institute of Medical Microbiology at Gresham University. Later, he was appointed as the chair of the medical microbiology at the University of Mainz. He has published more than 300 articles in the fields of immunology, bacteriology, and virology, and has received numerous awards, including the Order of Merit of Rhineland. His recent book, co-written with his biologist wife, Karina Reese, Corona False Alarm, Facts and Figures, was just released in the United States 4 days ago. It has already become a national bestseller in Germany and is rapidly receiving international attention. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Hello.
So much of the discourse has been focused on the political threats about the dangers of this coronavirus strain and measures that should be taken to protect ourselves and each other. And behind all of this noise, the discussion about what a coronavirus is, how this strain differs from other strains, and its comparison to the seasonal flu has been completely lost. They are calling this strain SARS-2. Now, despite the fact that we now know that SARS-1 was not that deadly and did not deserve the hype it was given. I'm sure most Americans are still unaware that coronaviruses are among the most common viruses contributing to common colds that require some or no medical intervention. This does not bode well for the heart of the controversies over the actual rates of infections and deaths being reported. For example, how many of the positive tests being reported are actually COVID-19 or another strain? Let's say someone had a COVID infection, a cold 10 years ago. How would we know that testing positive today, but otherwise having no symptoms and being healthy, was not a reflection of a long ago and, for all intents and purposes, non-infective viral particle that's still in their body. How would we know which virus it is, since the primary test being taken, the PCR, is non-specific on this issue? And also, let alone whether or not a person is actually positive to oversensitizing PCR cycles when testing samples. I want to discuss the diagnostic problems later, but first, please, based upon the research at your disposal, would you summarize this corona strain and how it is biologically distinguished and also being distinguished by medical and political authorities advocating for strict lockdowns and personal protective measures, also from the flu. The forum is yours. Take your time.
Thank you. Well, very basic. The coronaviruses have been amongst us since the beginning of mankind, and they circulate globally, worldwide, among animals and man, and going back and forth from animals to man and back again. As with all viruses that pervade the whole world, and these viruses are, generally speaking, not very dangerous. So they are among the most successful so-called parasites or viruses because they keep the host alive. They don't kill the host. This is the secret of their success. In fact, we have been coexisting with these viruses and these viruses with us in a peaceful manner, meaning that very seldomly does a coronavirus kill someone. In fact, it hardly ever kills unless that person, that individual, has a pre-existing illness. Now, this has been a general truth for all the coronaviruses except two up till now. These coronaviruses undergo mutational change all the time. So if you have a virus coming up today, within weeks or months, little parts of its gene will be changed spontaneously, just as humans, when they have their offspring, they also change. So no two humans are exactly alike. And these coronaviruses also change as they replicate, as they multiply. So it's a huge family, and there are so many variants and different family members amongst us today. So if you go to your neighbors, he may be infected with a coronavirus that you did not have, and he may not even know that he's infected, because most people don't really suffer very much under these coronaviruses. He may have a cough. He may have some fever. And then he would have enough virus, the virus load would be high enough to infect you. And if you have not had any contact with this virus before, you may also get a cough or a cold. And that's how things happen. So once in a while, all of us will get a cough and a cold, and many a time it will be a coronavirus that is behind the scenes. Remember, if you have children, you will remember the first winter your child went to the kindergarten. It was ill with cold and fever virtually all winter. One cold, one sort of mild flu would come around as soon as the first one was gone. At least that's how it happened with our child. But in the next year, you already have fewer colds, your child, and in the third and fourth year, things get better and better. Now, this all comes to be because your immune system gets to know the virus, the viruses, and you create a partial immunity against these viruses, and this immunity is a cross immunity. So because the viruses are very similar to each other, once you've taken care or have had a sparing bout with 10 of these, you can take care of the next 10 as they come around, because they're very similar. So the question is, why all this big fuss about the new virus? And the answer is, in fact, if we had made a fuss about the other coronaviruses that came around every year, and they do come every year, then we would be in a real difficult situation, because you wouldn't be knowing how to look for the next and deal with the next. They're all very similar. The answer is that these viruses have played such a low role, in fact, virtually no role in medicine, everyday medicine, because people so seldomly become so seriously ill that they have to go to the hospital, and so few victims of these viruses, this virus claims so few victims every year. So in fact, no one has gone to the trouble to develop tests to look and find these coronaviruses in everyday life. And even if you have a cold and fever and go to your doctor, he will not do a test for coronaviruses because it's not worth it. These virus infections come and go. And not until you get really seriously ill and have to be admitted to, let's say, the intensive care department, will people start looking for the coronaviruses. In fact, coronavirus diagnostics are virtually non-existent in practical medicine because they're just too expensive. It's not worth doing them. It's just like no one would think about diagnosing the common cold with an expensive diagnostic PCR test. Now, unfortunately, when this SARS-CoV-2 virus appeared on the scene in China, the limelight was set on it. Because of the publicity that came out of China, people said, wow, this must be a new virus, a new variant that is more dangerous than the others. And so a PCR test was developed in record time, within weeks, and without being really standardized and approved for diagnostic purposes, this PCR test took hold of the whole world, and everyone started looking for this virus. And where you start looking for a common virus, you will find it. And so, lo and behold, people found this virus around the globe within weeks. And everyone said, oh my God, we found the virus. And the WHO then did something that I find unforgivable, because the virus is called SARS-2 or SARS-CoV-2, which is it's very suggestive, because SARS-CoV-1 was the dangerous SARS virus that appeared in 2002-2003, which really had a higher lethality. That means that of 1,000 people who contacted the virus, about 100 would die, which was terrible, actually. But that virus was easy to contain and therefore did not spread. It wasn't as contagious. Now, when you start calling a virus SARS-CoV-2, then everyone says, oh my God, it's, you know, the brother of that terrible SARS-CoV-1. And maybe it's more contagious. So let's look for it. And worse still, of course, this virus did cause many people to become seriously ill. There are many factors that underlie this. And certainly there were victims of this virus, just as there are victims of the flu. Every flu season, people will die because of the flu. And we had deaths because of this new or so-called new virus. And the disease that it caused, although it was not new, it was a corona virus disease with a coronavirus illness, just as the flu is the flu. But it received a new name, and this new name was COVID-19, coronavirus 19. And this was really terrible, because the term COVID-19 was actually reserved for the serious illness caused by this virus, which in fact people thought might be new, but which turned out in the end not to be new. It was like any serious coronavirus infection. But then the WHO issued its guideline to say that every positive lab test, PCR test, was to be recorded and registered as a COVID-19 case, meaning that the lab test, which has told you that you could find the virus or whatever or parts of the virus gene, was to be equated with a serious illness. And because of that, the numbers of COVID-19 illnesses just skyrocketed within weeks. And the whole world panicked. All the health officials panicked because this terrible, potentially lethal disease, the numbers just soared from day to day, and they still are, although these numbers tell you nothing about the illness, because, in fact, it turned out that of 100 people who test positive with this virus PCR test, less than 10% will become seriously ill, and of those 10%, maybe 10% will die. So we're left with a lethality rate that is less than 1%, certainly less, because many cases are not detected at all. So in fact, we're down to a lethality rate that everyone now agrees on is well below 1%, which would take us to a lethality rate in the order of normal or of a serious flu at most. So that's the way things have happened the last 6 months. And it's led the whole world into such a mess. It's incredible to think about how this could have happened in the first place.
I appreciate that oversight. Thank you. I'm going to share a personal story. At the Tri-State Healing Center, as well as the Institute of Applied Biology, where I was a senior research fellow for 33 years, I noticed during a six-week period that I was counseling some women, average age 50, seemingly in good health, just normal women, nothing extraordinary. We're not presenting with any serious illness. But talking about fatigue. And we decided to do some blood chemistry and found that all five women I'd counseled, none of them knowing each other, all had hepatitis C. And yet when I questioned them about this, they had no recollection of how they could have contracted it. And then they remembered, oh yeah, back when I was in college, and then others at different times had done some things in their lifestyle that were probably contributing to it, or a blood transfusion in one case. So then that got me thinking, how likely is it that a lot of women have contracted at some point in their life a virus or a bacteria that later in life, when their immune system has been compromised by age and by lifestyle choices, now it manifests, and they're looking around thinking, how did this happen? So as just an experiment, we began to test every single patient that came into the center for herpes. And we found out that over 90% of the people who were otherwise completely healthy had herpes. And we told them we were going to test for this. But then we asked these people, have you had any outbreaks? And 90% said no. They didn't even know they had herpes. So what, and if you can see the analogy, so what would have happened had we not tested everybody now for COVID? How many people, asymptomatic or healthy immune system that fought it off, maybe mild situations, would have never known they had the virus versus those who have compromised immune systems because of comorbidities? And then those people would end up being, oh, okay, yes, we have a virus that can hurt people, especially those who are obese, heart disease, emphysema, cancer, et cetera, and therefore help those people with the medications and treatments they need and frequently weren't getting because there was no room left in the hospital for treating regular people. And a lot of people have died because they were not treated for what would have been treatable diseases, including cancer, surgeries. None of this was allowed for a long time. People forget that. So could you take those two points that what if we didn't call it a pandemic and didn't test everyone, would we have a different perspective on it? And what if we took the people that we knew were at great risk and therefore needed to be isolated and treated differently and treated those comorbidities to try to help them? Your thoughts, please.
Well, you're completely right, and that's what we have been trying to say all these months, and that's what we have put in our book. This test should have been forbidden because this test has caused the pandemic. It's a lab pandemic. It's not a medical pandemic. And this is the most terrible thing, is that this pandemic, or the fear of the pandemic, has been driving medicine in towards the medieval ages, back 500 years. The doctors have stopped practicing modern medicine, stopped looking at the patients that they should treat, stopped doing diagnosis in the way they should do. They stopped thinking, in fact. They are looking at a lab test and equating this test with the beginning of doom. I mean, this is so ridiculous and weird. We can't imagine that this can be. If it were only happening in countries with, excuse me, low education, that might be understandable. But that this is happening in America, in England, in all of Europe, the center of modern civilization, is something so incredible. And that this could lead to the mistakes that have been made in medicine. As you say, people who have not been taken care of, and we can tell you so many terrible, catastrophic stories about people who have suffered terribly because they've not been taken care of. In fact, I'll tell you, my mother-in-law is one of these people, tumor patients, terminal tumor, terminal cancer, that was just, you know, her whole treatment was stopped. And it's just terrible. And as you say, why don't we go back and tell people about this and say all this crazy fantasizing about a virus that, in retrospect, is definitely not more dangerous than the flu virus. This must be stopped. All this nonsense must be stopped as soon as possible, or we're going to be jumping off the cliff, all of us. In fact, that's what society has been doing now, driving the economy against the wall, driving the health of the people against the wall, the psyche. People are going mad because of these masks they have to wear, which are completely idiotic, trying to avoid contacting a virus that is not even there. We just don't know how the world could have come to be what it is.
I appreciate your sentiments. Thank you. Another issue that concerns me is that Occam's razor, the 14th century mystic and philosopher who said, use the razor to cut through the fat and get to the heart of the issue. And almost always the most reasonable answer is more often than not the correct answer. And yes, we confuse the simplicity of a solution with the complexity of the problem. And we make things completely complicated when they needn't be. And every layer of bureaucracy and every layer of political ideology that you throw into a health crisis only compounds the issue. I'll give you an example. We tell everyone initially, this is in the first 3 months, starting, let's say, in January, depending upon where you're at in the world, and they must take tests to see if they're infected. And so all these tests, over 247 different tests, were sent around the world. We now know that all those were not accurate. And so, but the initial public policies were based upon inaccurate data. Then we come up with a so-called gold standard, the PCR test, polymerase chain reaction test, for which someone I knew and was my friend, Dr. Kerry Mullis, won the Nobel Prize in 1993 in chemistry for discovering it. Now, Kerry Mullis made it very clear. In fact, I filmed him twice saying this. Do not use this test to determine viral activity. It is merely there for amplification of what is already there that you want to detect. And then by doing one layer after another, after another, after another of enhancement, you'll get it a billion times its size and you'll be able to see it. And yet today, they're using the PCR as if it tests positive, you're positive, which as you said, means you're infected. They're not distinguishing. They have in fact, conflated PCR positive with infection, and then they spur the danger of panicking. If I have the infection, I will die, no matter what your circumstances, age, health, or immune response. But then we start looking that the PCR in and of itself is not a confirmatory test. It is not specific to this COVID-19. It cannot differentiate which COVID they're measuring. And it could be measuring a COVID particle or virus that is years old and therefore not harmful at all. And yet none of this is discussed by politicians. None of this is discussed by the media. None of this is discussed by the scientists like Anthony Fauci at the CDC, who knows better. And so we have a consensus of stupid, a consensus of wrongheadedness, because they put the economic interest of the pharmaceutical industry, their career reputations would be destroyed, so they put their own career self-interest ahead of the truth of real objective science. So if we were really honest, in my personal opinion, we would not say that we have a gold standard test, and we would not be using the PCR as the definitive marker of whether or not you're infected and can infect others. Your thoughts, please.
I agree, of course. It's like, you drink 1 milliliter of vodka, you're not drunk. You drink 100 milliliters, you will be drunk. And if you are controlled, the police control us in Germany, you have this breath test, alcohol test. Now, the test will tell you, yes, you've drunk 1 milliliter, and it will also tell you, yes, you've drunk 100 milliliters. So both times the test may be positive, but it's only if you've drunk 100 milliliters the test goes to the point that the red limit has been reached, and therefore you lose your license. Now here, even if you only drunk 1 milliliter and the test is positive, it doesn't even have to be incorrectly positive, but you're not infectious and still you're sent, put in quarantine. I mean, this is absolutely ridiculous, don't you think?
Yes, I do. I do. Now, but all public policy is based upon that test, so therefore it's an inverted pyramid. Imagine the Great Pyramid at Gaza,
yes,
where the bottom of the top of the pyramid is now inverted upside down and the rest of the whole weight of the pyramid is resting on it. That's what I believe the coronavirus pandemic is doing today. The actual good science, qualified science, clinical experience, and observatory science is not being given any credibility, but rather a political science disguised as a public health science is supporting the facade of a public health response that is not working. Your thoughts, please.
Absolutely. The same opinion as yours. Very well said. And I must say that I was extremely pleased and relieved to hear Professor Scott Atlas talk, I think that was about 10 days ago, where in essence he was also saying this, and also saying that this pandemic is so hyped that it must not go on. I hope that the Americans have seen this interview with Scott Atlas. Have you actually?
Yes, I did.
Mm-hmm. I think he was speaking from the White House, in fact. So I was so happy to hear that, and I would urge you to spread the news that Scott Atlas was giving you.
We will. we're doing a program every day on this topic. In fact, we have today a top professor from Harvard, top professor from Stanford University, and top professor from Oxford University on to talk about why they believe that herd immunity is important and we should be allowing young people out and with the right knowledge so that they can become infected and then have herd immunity. That's their way of dealing with it. They believe that keeping people quarantined is the worst thing you can do and is not stopping the virus. Virus is not stopped by quarantine. Your thoughts on that, please.
And this is also what we have written in our book. So I suppose it's Professor Gupta from Oxford who's coming. Anyway.
Let me do this. We're going to take a break, and we're going to come back. Please, for our audience, please stay with us. Nice to have you with us, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. My guest on the phone right now from Germany is Dr. Sucharit Bhakti. That's Sucharit, last name Bhakdi. I want to reintroduce him because I don't know how long this interview will go. As I mentioned, we do have a top professor from Harvard, a top professor, and he correctly named her, from Oxford University, and a top professor from Stanford University, who all agree on one thing. And these are all ultra-Orthodox scientists and physicians that the quarantine doesn't work, that it actually causes a lot of suffering and preventable deaths, that people who would otherwise be able to go to a hospital and have treatment for a disease are frequently not given that. In fact, one of them has a friend that has terminal cancer and is dying now, because for 4 months that person was not allowed into hospital to have surgery and be treated with the therapy that could have saved their life because they were waiting for all of the COVID patients, which did not arrive. So we want to hear from them. However, I have so many more things to ask our current guest that we'll wait. If we have to delay that till tomorrow, we will do so. We also have one of the top lawyers in the world, also from Germany, who has got a whole consortium of lawyers, and they're interviewing in a tribunal scientists, physicians, about the discrepancies between the official version of what this pandemic's about and what the truth is. And they're also in this disclosure, and we played 15 minutes of it yesterday. I don't know that we'll have time planning today. We'll certainly play some tomorrow. They're stating that the antibody test is not accurate, that the death rates are not accurate, that many of the deaths, in fact, probably over half the deaths or more, were actually from comorbidities. And therefore, if you took out all of the non-COVID-related deaths, then you wouldn't have a pandemic. So to the idea that there's some agenda, keep them all together and just let it, a person dies in a plane crash, they died of COVID. This is how insane it's gotten. So that is a discussion they're having, and they intend to sue everybody involved. I'll just let you know that, and you'll hear more of that. And it's time that there was a pushback. By the way, very quickly, and we'll go right back to the guest, tonight, one of the most powerful voices, it's a Conversation with Remarkable Minds series, understanding the clash of worldviews underway and the need for a new context for constructive communication and dialogue to enact solutions, Dr. Elizabeth Sitoris, and I'll be talking with her in Hawaii. She's an evolutionary biologist, a philosopher, a futurist, a former professor specializing how the principles of nature can be applied to reorganizing our life. She's taught at MIT, University of Massachusetts. She is a heavyweight, a wonderful human being, and she'll be on tonight. You will not want to miss that show tonight. And next Tuesday, on the Progressive Commentary Hour, I'll be having for the entire hour Professor Stephen Adler. He is the William Hay Professor of Humanities, University of Wisconsin, and the entire hour is on one of my favorite philosophers, the 17th century philosopher Spinoza, and what he has to offer our modern society and the challenges ahead. And he was so far ahead of his time, And he died young at 44 in 1677. But we will talk with Professor Stephen Nadler next week. I'm bringing a lot more philosophers on the show every week, and those are two you won't want to miss. But now back to our current doctor who's on the line. Let me just reintroduce, because we have people throughout the whole hour tuning in. They may not know who he is. First of all, he has been a physician trained in Germany for a half a century, five decades. He received his medical degree from the University of Bonn, his postdoctoral work at the prestigious Max Planck Institute of Immunobiology and Epigenetics, before he became an associate professor at the Institute of Medical Microbiology at Dresden University. He was appointed the chair of the medical microbiology at the University of Mainz. He has published over 300 articles in the peer-reviewed literature in immunology, bacteriology, and virology. He's been awarded the highest orders, like the Order of Merit of Rhineland, and he is really experienced in all these fields he's talking about. And in his new book with his wife, Karina Race, Corona False Alarm, Facts and Figures, just released. And we have him in this exclusive interview. So back to you, sir. My next issue that I want to pick up on is right now, I don't know what the situation is in Germany, but here all of the attention is being focused upon getting a vaccine launched as soon as possible. Obviously, I have very serious concerns about Moderna's nano-engineered vaccine. Its technology has never been used in mass on a population. It is strictly experimental, and yet it's being targeted along with other vaccines for fast tracking. So first, does this virus even warrant a vaccine? And second, what are your primary concerns about this new generation of vaccine technologies that are being promoted, including the newest one likely to be mandated by people in the United States, if not around the world, that is putting untold numbers of nanoparticulate matter into your body, which then becomes a part of your DNA, and they claim they can communicate with your body and this. So I have deep concerns about anyone wanting to infuse what, in my opinion, would be a step towards transhumanism by putting something that they can communicate with into a person's body. Your thoughts, please.
Well, before I begin, let me say that I am an orthodox medical man. I am a staunch supporter and advocate of sensible vaccinations, diphtheria, tetanus, and others, not many others, but a few others. However, in the case of corona, I am an absolute opponent. I don't think this vaccination makes any sense at all. I don't think it can and will work. Regarding the gene-based vaccines, I would not quite go as far as you do, because the vaccines that are now being tested do not get incorporated in the genome. And so I do not see that danger as you do. However, I do see other dangers that cannot be overlooked at this stage. Now, why do I think that vaccination against COVID-19 is senseless? Simple answer. If you look at deaths because of this virus in people below 70 years of age in all of Europe, and I believe also America, although I don't really know the exact statistics in your country, but anyway, in Germany and in North Europe, the death rate of people under 70 is way below 1% because of the virus. If you take the death rate of people without pre-existing illness, the death rate for people under 70 is below 0.2%. Now, this means that you have a susceptible percentage of around 0.2% max. So if a vaccine is going to be developed, it has to be tested for its effectiveness, efficacy, and it has to be shown to reduce the mortality. How are you going to reduce a mortality or fatality rate of 0.2%? My question to anyone out there, to all the experts, to the pharmaceutical industry, my answer is you'll never do that. You cannot reduce a death rate that is so small in the first place, okay? So for the populace under 70 years, forget it. This vaccine is not needed and it cannot be tested for efficacy. Have I made myself clear, actually?
Yes, you're very clear. Yes.
Good. So we're left with the elderly population above 70, 75, with pre-existing illness, because if any person aged 80 or 90 who has led a healthy life and does not have a serious pre-existing illness, then he or she is also not likely at all to die because of this virus. In fact, we know so many elderly people above 75, 80, 90, even 100 years who survived an infection with the coronavirus very easily without even having to be admitted to the intensive care unit. So if you want to use a vaccine to protect those people, that vaccine is going to be have to be developed according to all the safety regulations to be sure that this vaccine is not going to cause any harm on these elderly people with pre-existing illnesses. And that is going to take a horribly long time. Any normal vaccine that is going to be developed according to the rules and regulations takes at least 5 years. And for this group of individuals with pre-existing illness, I don't know how long you'd need to do that, but it certainly cannot be done under a time frame of 5 to 7 years. So the very thought of a vaccine against COVID-19 being developed within 6 to 12 months is not sane. It is not right, and it mustn't be allowed, because if you do that, you would be trespassing all the rules and regulations that were made to have vaccine development develop along sensible, scientifically valid and sound lines. All right.
Okay. Now, hold on 1 second, please. A very important issue that is not being discussed that I'm aware of anywhere in the American media, it may be elsewhere, is that from the very beginning we have been told, in fact, there has been a refrain, do not talk about anything except the vaccine or a new series of drugs. We looked into the scientific literature. We've written several articles about 5 separate current drugs that are safe, that are effective, that are in the peer-reviewed literature on PubMed, over 50 of them, showing that things such as hydroxychloroquine with zinc and an antibiotic has a substantial prophylactic effect and can help people if used in low doses at the beginning of symptoms, and yet it's been attacked mercilessly, even in spite of the literature being there and clinical experience. Separately, in immunology, having a strong immune system is the cornerstone of defending yourself against all disease, not just viral bacterial nature. And so Richard Gale, myself, my producer, who's a scholar, we went to PubMed and we wrote 2 articles showing only just peer-reviewed literature of what the scientific standards were for a healthy diet, exercise, stress management, and specific nutrients, such as astragalus, that has a lot of scientific studies showing it supports helping with upper respiratory tract viral infections, vitamin D, vitamin C. And we publish these and broadcast them. And then the media says, don't anyone be trying anything on your own. In fact, people were told not to take care of themselves. And there was no discussion And now I see that Anthony Fauci just last week said, oh, yeah, and I take vitamin C and vitamin D, et cetera, every day to help my immune system. Well, why weren't you telling the American public to lose weight and have a nationwide, if not a worldwide, anti-obesity program, a pro-heart health program, a pro-pulmonary program? None of these things that could have been done and helped a lot of people stay healthy, or if they got sick, shorten that sickness and save their life, has been mentioned. It's all been about a vaccine or a new drug that has never been on the market before at a very high price. Your thoughts, please.
I'm with you on every point. We've also said this in our book, and it's been ridiculous because, as you say, the main risk for dying of COVID-19 are obesity, diabetes, heart attack, lung infection, cancer, because of too much smoking. But anyway, I'd like to come back to this refrain about why we would need a vaccine so that we have protective antibodies, which is absolutely ridiculous. The fact is that antibodies that might protect you against an agent, a bacteria, toxin, or a virus will only work if that agent disseminates in the body via the bloodstream, because it is only in the bloodstream that the concentration of antibodies that might be protective are reached. So on the lining of the airway epithelium, you will never have enough antibody to protect, to catch the viruses that are coming in as a tsunami. And so that is the reason why there is no effective vaccination against any agent that comes into your body via the air, via the respiratory tract, and stays in the lung. Those that come into the respiratory tract and then disseminate via the bloodstream, against them, yes, you might have a vaccine, all right, measles or, chickenpox. Now, in the case of antibodies, therefore, it's a matter of whether you believe that the antibodies are the primary arm of the immune defense that protects you against the virus, the coronavirus. And the fact is that most people do not realize that the second arm of our immune system, which consists of the lymphocytes, the T lymphocytes, they are probably much more important than the antibodies, because these lymphocytes come into play after the virus has successfully entered the cells of the airway epithelium, and after the virus has multiplied there, what happens is that during this process of the virus multiplying in the cell, waste products of the virus are generated that the cell puts in front of its door or hangs on its door as a sign. And this sign or the waste products are recognized by your lymphocytes, especially the killer lymphocytes recognize this waste product and then come and destroy the cell so that the factory is destroyed, the fire is extinguished, and the patient will get up, the cough will go away, and he can go back to work if he has work in these corona times. So this is something that causes me to believe that the interaction between the older coronaviruses and our lymphocytes goes a long way back, and our lymphocytes have been trained to recognize the waste of even the new coronavirus, because the waste products are very similar to each other, since the mutations go along very slowly in these viruses, or they take place in small steps, let's put it that way. So, in fact, 3 months ago, a series of papers started to appear that all showed the same thing, which is that our memory T lymphocytes recognize the waste products of the new, so-called new coronavirus, because this new coronavirus is still related to the old coronaviruses. In fact, what our immune system is telling us is that this coronavirus, SARS-CoV-2, is not new at all. And in fact, that would be a reason to say the pandemic has never taken place, because it is not a new virus and the disease is not new, and therefore the WHO would have no grounds to say there is a pandemic. There is actually no scientific ground for continuing to say that this is a pandemic. The virus is not new. Our T lymphocytes recognize it, and the illness is also not new. So in the end, I don't know what we're talking about. Now we go even one step further and want to develop gene-based vaccines. These gene-based vaccines that are now being developed currently and on the forefront are messenger RNA vaccines, where the messenger RNA is injected into your body. This does not enter your genome. So that, I think, we have to keep at a very low level. But the gene that is now injected into the body of the volunteers, the vaccinees, get into cells in the body, which no one knows where this happens and how many cells get which. And then the gene product is produced, and these are the spikes, the protein that the virus uses to get into the cell. That is the spike protein. And it's this spike protein that your cells then produce. But as your cells produce this spike protein, waste products are bound to also be generated, and these waste products are bound to be put in front of the door of that cell that has taken up the gene. And this is what we warn everyone about in our book. We believe that this might trigger an autoimmune reaction, because the killer lymphocytes, which we know are there, cannot but recognize that waste product that has been put in front of the door by the cells that have taken up this gene and producing the gene product. And we cannot but think that these cells are going to be attacked by the killer lymphocytes, because that is actually their job. This is what we have written. We have said that it is our opinion, and we cannot prove that it's right, because these experiments have never been performed in animals to see whether what we fear might really take place. But
we're nearly out of time. I just want to mention that we have tens of millions of Americans suffering from autoimmune conditions at the present time, cancers, heart disease, diabetes, and obesity right now. You're looking at over half the American population. So just imagine what the autoimmune responses could be. And I believe that it's irresponsible what they're doing. That's just my personal belief. Last quick answer, if you would, sir. Have you studied to see what the actual death rate is from the virus versus what it's been attributed to be, and how much of a difference is there?
Well, the case fatality rate is certainly no more than 0.1 to 0.3%, which is in the range of normal flu. And much less than what the WHO and what all the official the statements were at the beginning of this pandemic, where the case fatality rate was stated to be around 4 to 5%. So we're looking at a discrepancy of at least tenfold and possibly 50-fold.
Thank you very much. I look forward to another conversation with you. We have a lot more to discuss. You're in very much in alignment with Dr. Harvey Raich at Yale University and Stanford's John Ioannidis and others who are saying that we have to look for the truth, not look at what is the official version of this. So I want to thank you very much, Dr. Socharit Bakhtri, for coming on today and sharing your points of view. His new book, by the way, is Corona False Alarm, Facts and Figures, just released with his wife. And he has been an author of 300 peer-reviewed studies in the fields of immunology, bacteriology, and virology. He's been a practicing physician, orthodox physician, for 50 years. So he is a heavyweight, and he is speaking truth to power, and that's what we appreciate. Sir, thank you very much for your courage.
Thank you, and goodbye.
Bye. From Germany, I'm Gary Nall. Thank you all for listening, and have a nice day.